It's getting later in the week. Because in the beginning, remember that first day that we met? You all sat so quiet. 2 minutes to 4 o'clock, you were already hushed and quiet. Now here it is Wednesday, 4 o'clock, and you're still talking, and I have to talk. Okay, I'm going to start. I'm Walt Wongren, Jr. I noticed that other people were giving where they came from and so forth, so I'll say that Than and I and four children live in Evansville, Indiana. Our children are ages 12 through 16, and we attend Grace Lutheran Church there in Evansville. The title of this entire series is an autobiography of faith. I have been changing the part titles every single day as I think through what's going to happen here and as I try to sharpen and make sure that they're the best, and so I have changed this one as well. Whether it'll be written on the outside of the tape or not, it doesn't matter, because I'm saying it here and whoever listens will hear it. I changed it from the self's emergence to the self's ascendancy, which is a bit different. I need to identify the fact that this is going to be, even though it'll feel as though we come to closure at the end of this hour, that this is really the first half of a longer drama, which is followed up by the self's failure. They don't always feel like two halves, and not always do people who have experienced the self's ascendancy then thereafter experience the self's failure. But often enough that the two halves perhaps do make a whole. I'd like to begin first by very honestly thanking you all. I really, truly mean this. I want to thank you for listening to me. Well, because the fact that you're here forces me to think through things more carefully than I otherwise would think through. You nerve me. I get so scared, and I have to, that fear is wonderful energy to think and think and think to make sure that what I'm going to say is as straight and clear and as true as I can possibly make it. And what that does for me is that it forces me to certain discoveries that I perhaps hadn't had before. That's the first reason I thank you. The second reason that I'm thanking you, though, is because you must know that a storyteller has a kind of an inbred fear, recognizing that the storyteller doesn't do everything in the telling of the story. The listeners do at least as much as the storyteller does. And I thank you because you are working. You are working with me, whether you know it or not. Here is the storyteller's fear: that the story which is told will be too personal or too eigentlich, too particular, and maybe even too selfish, so that when it is heard, it will be simply like watching somebody's slides on vacation, where the listener smiles but knows that it doesn't have an awful lot of application to her while she's listening to it. What the storyteller wants to happen is for that story to become somehow or other solemnly universal, even with the laughter, sincerely universal, and that what is told in the story embraces the various particular memories and lives and experiences of the hearers. But the storyteller works at doing that, but it's the hearers who unconsciously do work as well to begin to find points of reference and details, not just to dwell in the storyteller's story, but to find that the storyteller's story illuminates their lives. You do that for me, and I thank you for that. I truly do. You must know my gratitude for your work. I'm suggesting now that this is the third chapter of this autobiography. The first chapter looked at the infant's close relationship to the deity, unknowing perhaps, but experienced nonetheless, where the deity was very, very active, I say. The deity was active in that child's life. And over a period of time, the child could begin to respond to, know something of what we call the mysterium tremendum, that thing which both frightened and allured the child. Yesterday we said that there ought to come, but doesn't always come, the language to take this very subjective experience of the child and make it objective. This is theology. This is the activity and the responsibility of the church, the community, the caretakers, those who have a care for this child. This is what we said yesterday. that the language is the ritual of the church, it is the theology of the church, it is the catechetics or the teachings of the church, it is the clear proclamation of the church, it is all of those things which the church self-consciously has discovered in Scripture and in the acts of God, which name and which define how God works with the people, so that the child now can begin to learn the names and the language for these things which went on kind of, as it were, in secret and very privately for that child. The beauty of this is that the child is then invited into community. The child has that shining moment of a sense of participation, a profound discovery that what had been private, fearfully private before, isn't. That it is the experience of many, many people. And that these people know something, and they're not scared of what's going on, and they can identify future events that are to take place, and they can name them. So the child then is a part of community. What happens after that, what I'm going to talk about today, this self-ascendancy, I don't know that it is altogether universal. I cannot say that, and I will not push it as a principle. But I think that it is common enough that my telling you my story will ring bells also in your past as well. I think that it is common. The reason that I'm not so sure about its universality is because I'm afraid that our church does not have much ritual to help this thing to happen. And I think that is a problem. What I think happens now, you know, when we come to that moment where the child is finally able, after language has made firm and affirmed the faith, where the child is herself able to confirm that faith before other people, and the parents are sitting out there smiling, and everybody's happy. At that point, everybody, I think, kind of expects or wishes that this process of faith would halt. It should stop just there, because all things are good. For the child, God is good. For the parents, the child is good. For the community, everything is in Ordnung. It's in order. I have to use German sometimes for these things, because that's a little bit different from just saying in order. It's in Ordnung. It's all right, and it's all proper, and it's all explained, and every question has an answer. And I'm not mocking this. For a moment, things are shalom. And this child who has come to that confession of faith, that confirmation of faith, and everybody has, in all the various ways they have, applauded her, maybe given her a breakfast or a dinner, and all the relatives came over because it was her confirmation, and applauded, gave her presents, and so forth and so on. That child knows shalom, as perhaps she has not known it before, which I mean wholeness, a fulfillment, a fulfillment of the relationships that before then had been kind of yearning and nameless. I think everybody would like it to stop there. I know I would, did, when my kids were there, but it doesn't. I think the process or this drama or this biography continues. And now comes one long story, which I'm calling the self-ascendancy, but I think what happens now is that the individual needs to gnothesauton, to know herself. It's the Greek word. The trouble is that beginning to know ourselves means that we have to go through a process of self-definition. I use that word on purpose. We have to define ourselves. I say have to, but I don't mean that at all. I mean that it happens compulsively. And for many, many people, it happens at about adolescence, when the self begins to change, and the names that I used to have for myself don't cover all the things that are happening in me anymore. Definition is good and frightening. Definis, to define something, means to find the boundaries of it, the borders of it. To find the borders of myself, follow this, means that I must learn it in separation. I must separate. There is now, I think, and I don't think we always choose to, although some teenagers demand it, but I think that it comes from something compulsive. They demand separation. They demand, fancy word, leave-taking. A leave-taking happens, and it's a profound leave-taking. It's deeper than any teenager anticipated what it would be. And for some people, maybe it doesn't happen until the 20s or the 30s, but it happens. And it comes explosively. It comes, I think, with a whole raft of emotions, which perhaps do not have names. There is a defining that goes on. And it is not mental, it is experiential. And sometimes it is as though I said, let me be free. Let me be free, I said, because I desire nothing so much as I desire freedom. What I did not realize was that freedom was a roller coaster. And as I was cranking up the track, I felt good as I could see the world from a high Olympic viewpoint. And then when the track curved and it seemed to go easy, all of a sudden I realized that free meant free fall. And that all those things which once had protected me with their definitions were gone. It's a sort of a birth. It really is. But it's a birth, I'm afraid, is unritualed and uncompanioned in our culture. When you go down that roller coaster, then your tummy starts to twist, and then you start screaming words that you didn't know you knew before. I say it's like a birth because I saw Joseph be born. And I remember a moment that I had when Joseph came out into the world. I mean, all kinds of wonderful, joyful things were going on at that moment. And hard things. Santa was working so hard. And I was working too. I've mentioned this before every once in a while, but I will mention this to the end of my days. Fan was doing the puffing and the blowing. She was riding on top of her pain. I think that's how I thought of it in my head. That the pain never rode over Fan, but she was always on top of that pain by her blowing and her working, and I had the hard labor of holding her shoulders up. And huffing and puffing and blowing along with her. And I won't tell you the whole story. All I will say is that we were in the delivery room together, and they set up a little mirror above us, which is about the size of a Volkswagen mirror. And that's so that I could see, and Fan could see all the stuff that was going on at the other end of Fan. I didn't know how, I'm going to get, this is all fitting. I'm going to get in a little while to some of these connections and divisions that go on with his definition. I don't know how much Fan knew of what was going on at the other end of Fan. She, I'm sure, knew much more than I did. But that was the problem. That's the separation. Nevertheless, people told me what was happening. And they told me how to feel about it. They said, the baby's crowning. I thought that's a wonderful word, crowning. I really did. I never heard that before at all. Is that what they say? Crowning. And that means, I guess, that the top of the head is beginning to appear in this Volkswagen mirror down there. And so that's, they told me what was happening. It was like the baby's getting its crown. I thought, that's so wonderful, the baby is being crowned. But then they said, and it's beautiful. And I looked in that mirror, and what I saw, crowning, was a little mud ball. I said, it's beautiful. And then the baby, there was an episiotomy, and that was not beautiful. It just took my breath away to see how pale Fan's flesh could be. All of a sudden, so pale, I hadn't seen that color before. But then the baby came out. Quick, and it described an arc through the air and landed on Fan's chest. Well, it was what the nurses were doing. They took that baby and they so quick suctioned out its nose and suctioned out its mouth and brought it up like this, and then they were going to put it on Fan's chest. And as I have mentioned before, some of you have heard me, it was at the peak of that arc. It was at the zenith. It was at that moment, just when Joseph began to come down, that I saw his face and my heart went out to the child. He threw his hands like this, and his puffy little eyes, which had been closed tight at that moment, went wide, and he took a big breath. And I was, as it were, living in Joseph, and I felt what Joseph was feeling. It was as though somebody had taken both of us by the scruff of the neck and pulled us out of a warm place, pulled us out of a world where we could touch always our world, where the definition, hear me, this is the point, where the definition of me was the world. My definition was my world around me. I knew me by touching the womb wall. I'm guessing. What do I know? I don't remember. Mom, I don't remember. But I think maybe something like that, where I could feel that womb wall around me. And so the world touching me showed me exactly what my proportions were. And all I had to do was flinch, move, blink, swallow. And I could feel both my world and me all at once. And suddenly I was snatched out of that world to something where I could touch nothing, nothing at all. And this nothing was cold and void. And on top of all that, they dropped me. I think that's what happens here. Maybe not quite the same way. But to find oneself, to define oneself, often means that there is a compulsive separating even from the theologies that we had accepted. I don't think we do that on purpose all the time. From the doctrines, from the family, from the community, from the church. The Oglala Sioux Indians have a ritual which they call Hanblayachi, I think. Do you know it? It's translated the crying for a vision. I think it's wonderful. It comes in adolescence. I think that it recognizes what I'm describing to you, but it ritualizes it. The child, male, female, is purified first. Then one who is helping this child, although, you know, I must say child, but instantly when this is over, then it's a woman, then it's a man. The one who is helping this child after the purification walks with her. She walks on her own feet. She's stripped almost all the way down. Walks with her to a high and lonely place. When they get there, the helper builds or plants, where did I put, here it is, plants five staves in the ground. One is in the center, and it's a very large staff. One is to the west, one is to the north, one is to the east, one is to the south, and all are exactly 10 paces from the central staff. Then, I get this, by the way, from this book, The Sacred Pipe, Black Elk, Seven Rituals of the Oglala Sioux Indian. This, for me, is a blessing. Then, the one who is doing the crying. You must understand, this crying for a vision means crying, lamenting, crying, crying. It's crying. The one who is doing this crying, who is seeking for a vision, who is looking for and is aware of what she's looking for, who is looking for a transition in life, a discovery, a vision itself, a vision which will name him, her, thereafter, and which will give him or her purpose in life. It's very much like what I said God did in creation, naming things. It gives a name, it gives a relationship, it gives a purpose. She will come with nothing on, moccasins are off, because, says Black Elk, you must know the perfect humility, the poverty that we have for this thing to happen. You must be without any goods whatsoever. And enter into this cross which encompasses the world. It is so beautiful. This, the point is that the whole world is encompassed in this. This one enters in and must walk only on the paths that go between the staves. Comes to the center and then cries a prayer. Oh, Wakan Tonka, be merciful to me that my people may live. What a lovely prayer. Oh, Wakan Tonka, oh, greatest being of all, be merciful to me that my people may live. Comes with a pipe, with the sacred pipe. Please, better word than peace pipe. Lifts the pipe, or aims that pipe in the six primary directions, to the earth, and prays the prayer. That is, to Unshi. Unshi is grandma. It is that from which springs all living things. To each of the distances, I can't take long to tell you this sweet thing, but walks here crying and then prays the prayer to the west and then comes back and walks into the north here and here. And then finally to Tukashila, which is the grandfather's sky. Tukashila, the same prayer. Oh, what a universe they have. And don't you know this person is becoming... Now, several things are happening in this ritualized experience. By deprivation, that's significant, that is, this person does not eat nor drink for as many as 4 days to a week. By deprivation, this one begins to know herself as she never knew herself before. There is a separation that goes on. The helper is gone. No humans are here at all. This is utter loneliness, and that's part of what these tears are all about. This is an oppressive sense of the burden of the people. And an oppressive sense of one's personal burdens at this same time. There is an utter separation that goes on here. There is a de finis, there is a defining of this one as the weeping goes on and the prayer goes on. The second thing is, and this is in the same process, that there must be an exquisite listening. This is one of the phrases that the Sioux use to their children again and again. I've heard this phrase often myself. I didn't know that it was holy. It is, pay attention. They say, pay attention, pay attention. But what they're meaning is not pay attention to me. Pay attention to the world. All the world talks. All the world reveals. All the world may give the mystery and give the key. And so at this point, in this utter loneliness and this separation, there is a demand, apart from people and apart from community, that there be a paying attention to the world. Because anything may speak. And it may not speak at first. It may simply come and look at you. It may be a bird that lands on one of those staves while you're there and cock its eye and look at you. Well, you hush. You hush at that moment because it may talk to you. It may not. And most often that bird will fly away. Or it may be so tiny, say the Indians, as the little ant that will crawl in close and clickle, clickle. I think it's clickle, clickle. They say, whisper in your ear. Pay attention, they say, to all these things. But first comes this unutterable separation. And then second, in this paying attention, and here's the second thing now, there comes a profound sense of humility, of emptiness, of being cleansed out, so that I may hear what the world is about to say. And then as the crying goes on, this may or may not happen, it may be that the bear may come, and the bear will talk, say, Waskin Mani, the name of an Indian, and say something that the Indian may not even understand. Give a vision, maybe dance, that's all. Or it may be the spotted eagle, or maybe the ant. And then when this child, no longer a child, is brought back again into the community, repurified, sits down, the pipe is passed around, and then they say, okay, what did you hear? What did they say? And then if it was a bear that spoke, then the name of that person will be taken from the bear thereafter. If it was a horse, it could be Crazy Horse, even though sometimes the names are passed down from people to people. I'm telling you this for a very good reason. It is, I think, wonderful that this culture has ritualized a process which I suspect takes place anyway. That is, both that separation, that utter separation, and then at the same time thereafter, this complete ability of emptiness and humility. I think we are not so fortunate. This is just me. I don't know if I can back it up, and I'm not a psychologist, sociologist, whatever. I speak just from my own experience. I think that we have no rituals for this anymore. I think confirmation used to do something like that, but I don't think it does anymore. And what I think happens is, because we don't have rituals, because we don't have the community serving this process, because nobody is leading us step by step through it, because we don't even expect it to happen, because it kicks us like surprise in the rear end and suddenly snatches us away, because of all that, this neat duality of the Oglala Sioux for us is split into two parts. We go through the separation, but for us, separation does not lead immediately to humility. It leads to arrogance. There's nobody to lead us to the paying attention. What happens is we fill up with ourselves. This is what I think happens. And I don't blame anybody for this. I think it's an almost natural response that A, follow me now, that compulsively I begin to find myself by separation and feeling my delimits and who I am, but that B, because I am in that kind of a loneliness and a separation, when I seek to fill in the fears that come from free fall, what do I have but myself? And so I end up with the self-ascendancy. I'm going to describe this to you. This is my experience. But then for us, where the Sioux could do it in 4 days, and I think they really did it. For us, then what happens is the self's failure, which is a bit more painful than going without food and water for 4 days, I think, even though we fear food and water being lacking and so forth. Okay. I'm going to tell you a story I have never told before in public. That's why I thank you so much at the beginning, get you in the proper mood to be kind to me. I never have. I have never told this in public before. It is not necessarily, in fact, it is not a cheerful story. It's a painful story. I don't tell it in pain. You must know that. And you must know I do not tell it with blame, nor with self-pity, either one. I blame no one for this, and I do not pity myself for this. I don't think what I'm going to describe is, I plan to say this to you, so catch it. I don't think what I'm going to describe is so much bad as it was necessary. For me, it was probably more intense than for other people, but my telling it to you may also define some of the things that happened for you. I went away to school when I was very young. You've seen me in Chicago, you've seen me in Canada, and now you must see me in Milwaukee. You must see me at Concordia. It was called Concordia Junior College, but it was 4 years high school and 2 years college. I went in high school. It was an all-male school. It doesn't exist that way anymore. Thank the Lord. Those kinds of schools don't exist anymore. It was the kind of initiation that I had, that's the other word for what we're talking, that I had not anticipated. I went short, small, shy, all the things that you can imagine most kids are, but don't show, okay? I went lonely, and I went not knowing exactly what to expect. I remember when Mom and Dad took me up there, and I felt relatively proud. I was going to carry the Wandrin name. Well, I was the oldest kid, you know. first one to leave home and all that kind of stuff. And besides, it was the Missouri Synod. And any of you who have been in the Missouri Synod knows something about, well, you sit in a class, what's the first thing these teachers used to say? Wandrin, is your dad, your grandpa, all that kind of stuff. And so it was sort of like, all right, you're acceptable, but let's see what you can do now for the Synod, the kingdom of God. And I remember having my picture taken and smiling and all that kind of stuff and then being left there alone. And I was by nature scared, but Milwaukee helped me to be scared. I mean, it was as though I had a right to be scared, and it got just worse every day for a year. I tell you, this is not in blame and self-pity, because this happens, I think, for everybody, but at various levels, different ways, and different experiences. It was not a nice place to be, okay? They had what, you know, wasn't as bad as when my dad went. They had cooled it down a little bit since then. He went to a different school, but it was the same system. They had shagging and hazing, yeah. Oh, I mean, fun. It was fun. Two upperclassmen, we named us, you know, we were really a tight society because each class had its own name, sexta, quinta, quarta, tertia. You know those names? Those Latin numbers. Sexta was freshman, quinta was sophomore, quarta and so forth on up to prima. The upperclassmen, the quinnies, or the tertianers, would come and meet you in the hall and smile on you with broad smiles. They'd make you feel big, and they would say, do you want to play with us? And you'd say, yes. I said, yes, smiling back at them. They said, good, you be the playing field. And I stood there, and this was, I mean, it wasn't just me. This is common stuff. And I was the playing field, and so one guy hauled off and hit me in the left shoulder. Well, this wasn't the game I had planned on playing. And then the other guy hauled off and hit me on the right shoulder. And then instantly the game changed. I didn't get to do any hitting at all. And they said, now you're the referee. Who hit the hardest? And well, you innocent child, you say, well, Herman, you hit the hardest. And immediately George would demand a rematch. And that could go on as long as they want. You understand. This is so, no, Milwaukee didn't help a whole lot with my fears. You could push a wet wad of gum across the floor until you didn't have skin on your nose. This kind of stuff went on. They were not kind. And I began this process of definition. I began a separation. I began separation from home. I began separation from other people. I began separation from classmates, which I had never really known. And there was something wrong in the air. Now, I think this is world's air. And I think it is not uncommon, I keep repeating that to you, but it was harsh and it was focused there. In the classroom, they were not gentle to teachers if the teacher showed any weakness. There was a man whose name was Barr, as much as I'll tell you, he taught geometry. And he was, I think, a gentle soul, and his gentleness was interpreted as weakness. It's sort of like the scriptural word meek. You know, Moses was the meekest of people, but meek only meant in Moses that Moses obeyed God and was strong on the earth. But we took that word meek and we turned it into something which you hear right now on the streets, even in Holden. Wimpy, wimpy, wimpy. All right? Well, I think that's how they saw Barr. And I remember while he would teach geometry, writing his triangles and circles on the blackboard like that, George Firehammer would put his face down and start saying, Barr beats his wife, Barr beats his wife, Barr beats. And then Jerry Nikolaus would pick it up, and then others would pick it up, and pretty soon the whole classroom was saying, Barr beats his wife, Barr beats. And my ears were burning. I didn't know where I stood in all that. On the one hand, I did not want to say Barr beats his wife, because I watched what Barr did when he heard this. On the other hand, I didn't want to be separated from that class. I did not want to. And this was, for me, a dilemma. I could not. I shrank from the dilemma because I could not explain it. And Barr would stop at the blackboard and turn around. I tell you this so that you might know, oh, not just how your pastors came to be, but how this world is. And first Barr would begin to preach love to the people. Really preach love. If try to use Bible texts to talk about you don't do this if you love, and so forth and so on. If Barr beats his wife, movie. The second thing that he would do is just stand and stare at the class. And then the third thing is that he went to the back of the room and sat down on the piano. And I watched him, and he cried. and he was a man. And his tears on the piano keys. They had succeeded. I was not comfortable in this place. I was in room 314, third story of Wunder Hall, right out over the tennis courts. And I remember sitting up in the tennis courts and staring out the window, sitting up in my window and staring out the window at the courts. My desk was right beside the window itself. And I had a collection of feelings. I had a host of feelings. One is that I saw my classmates playing tennis on the courts, and they were so free, and they were so happy. They had little songs that they sang back to one another. They knew each other's names. They all knew their nicknames. And somehow nicknames clogged in my throat. I couldn't say nicknames. I could hardly say names. But I, at that time, we had strict proctors. That's what we called them, proctors, right? You know what that is? People who watch over the dormitory, upperclassmen who lived in the dorm. They would walk around. It's amazing to me they could do these things. What a world. They could walk in their underwear and nothing else on. Swaggering down with rat-tailed towels. And they'd snap the butts of quinnies and sexties and one another. I mean, they were free with it, everybody. But they frightened me. Oh, they frightened the other guys. Now, you must understand, other people in this whole milieu, I think they did all right by it. I think they swam in those waters. I couldn't very well. I mean, I remember a time when my roommate was bouncing a tennis ball against the door, and Eilenfeld threw open that door and stood there and glared at him. His name was Bob Gartsky. Eilenfeld said, "Ha!" Gartsky froze. He said, "You hit tennis balls in this room or you get crap marks." So we called them crap marks. You get a whole lot of crap marks. You do a lot of schlock? No, not schlock. Schock? What is that German word for work? Oh. What? What? Okay, we call it Schaffner. That's what it was. Yes, okay, so you got that. Oh, you see what a closed community this is. And I sat at my desk trembling, and when the door closed, Gartsky didn't bother Gartsky at all. But the people down on the tennis courts had to be in on time because there were people like Eilenfeld on the inside, but they came so casually. All these little things I remember I sketch in for you. Dick Rosenberg. He used to come in every single night, just singing so peacefully. I yearned to be a part of Dick Rosenberg. I wanted to walk off of that tennis court at peace, not worrying about proctors. He said, "Ich muss gehen, ein Piss zu nehmen." I remember that. I wouldn't be so foul, except that Dick was first. I yearned to sing songs like that. I yearned to be a part of them, but I couldn't be. Don't you understand that when the separation begins, for whatever reason, there is a whole collection of feelings. On the one hand, there is a sense of self-wonder. You did not know you were such a being before. You did not know that you had such a shape or such talents before, because the separation objectifies who you are. At the same time, there is a kind of a sense of self-loathing, and both of those things are there. It's like touching the matted hair for the first time, and it ruins the fingers. It hurts. It's too the sensitive fingers can't quite take. So you are wonderful. You are loathsome. I was wonderful. I was loathsome both at once. At the same time, you look at the world from this objectivity, and you see it more clearly than you ever saw it before. And that is in itself a wonder. You never saw the blue. I never saw the blue of the sky, so blue, nor understood what azure was, as in those days. I had lived too closely to the sky before. Now, being somewhat separated from the sky, I could marvel at it. On the other hand, I could see what was filthy in the world as well. So clearly, this is a confusing time. I remember walking into the museum, and there was, I must share this moment with you, because this is all part of this thing, even though it doesn't have names in this kind of weird world. I was looking into the little cases where they showed past civilizations, and I hope you take this right. I came to a case of primitive people. They had them all set up in figures. They were fairly large figures, male and female, but the female were not dressed above the waist. So I could see them from the waist up. And I had a moment, now be careful with how you respond, I had a moment of transport. I was transported as I looked at the woman. It was not sexual transport. It was that I marveled that people were different one from the other. It was the first time that had struck me how different people are. I'd always assumed that I could know all people. I'd always assumed that somehow I dwelt in people. But during this process, there came, and with it came double feelings, triple, quadruple feelings. On the one hand, when I looked at woman and I looked at breasts and I said, I don't have those things. To me, the first thought was, then how can I know who they are? it was just like a symbol for all the various differences that I was even not aware of. And so the two feelings were, one, it was almost mystic. I thought, what a marvelous thing it must be to be a woman. Because that's what I'm not. Don't you understand? And to have feelings that I could never have had, nor therefore describe. I stood in front of this case just transfixed. Like that. As was the, but then the second thing that went through my mind was almost a wave of loneliness. But if I cannot know how they feel, how can they know how I feel? How can we know one another at all? That's how I felt then. I'm wiser now. I'm beyond. But at that, and so there were the double thing. And then there was also, here was the self marvel. I thought, well, they have things I don't have. I have things they don't have. Well, that means that I have feelings they don't have. Marvelous that I have these feelings. But I can't tell them to them. How can I tell them to them? So there was at one and the same time this sense of the sweetness of the world and the sense of loneliness among them. Do you understand what I'm saying? All this at once. All this here going on. I sharpen it for you, and maybe not quite so consciously for others. At Thanksgiving, a guy named Garvin and two other guys, I use these names because I truly don't think you will ever meet them, plus I'm changing some of them. A guy named Garvin and another guy went into the park. And this is a piece of all that happens. And they met a girl there. And fooled around, as we say, or said, went all the way. Except Garvin didn't go all the way. The others did. This is just around Thanksgiving time, just after Thanksgiving. Garvin went to Dean Ackman, that's the true name, and told Ackman what they had done in the park. And I was sitting behind my desk, and I was looking out of the third floor of Wonder, and I noticed all these heads looking out, and how solemn and silent everyone was, because this other fellow's father, who was a pastor, had come to school to get his son, who had been expelled. And you know, we all knew this. And it was as though we were an audience, three stories up, hanging out of the window to see. And the father came, and that father was mighty as a giant with a shining bald head and a severe German face with jowls. Jowls. Now, I used to think that this other guy, the son, who had done this fooling around, was big. He was certainly bigger than I was. But when that guy walked beside his father, he was shriveled up in time because this was a mighty father. And I think we had the common feeling of, what's going to happen to him? It was a moment of community. I took that information home. I don't know if you remember, Dad. But at Christmas time, I told you that this is what so-and-so had done. I did that to let you know that I knew about sex. Sort of indirect way to say that I knew about sex. It's okay. You know, it's all right. I knew. But no fault of yours. You didn't understand that was my hidden, deep, deep, hidden agenda. Nobody understands what's the hidden agenda of these people going through these things. Don't you understand? They don't even know what the agenda is. That's the broadness of this separation. But because they don't, because a father doesn't understand the agenda, then there is a sense of alienation. You didn't know the thing that I had said. And so I was home, but I was still alone. And when we went back to school again, you must know, on 27th Avenue in Milwaukee, there is a Red Star yeast factory, and they have a red star as a sign around a clock. We went back in the evening, and when I saw that Red Star yeast sign go bigger and smaller, that's what it did. It went beep, 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 beep. I nearly threw up. That was Milwaukee. That was Concordia. That was the sign or the symbol in my mind of that into which I was going once again, and I couldn't stand it. But I couldn't tell anybody. Couldn't tell them. Not at all, because I was doing such a rotten job of upholding the Warren Group name. Well, when we got back, I got very, very sick. I went into the hospital. I really thought that Tilly Funtu, who was the nurse, would not accept me because I thought I was faking. Everything I did, I thought was a fake, but I was always afraid. Yet she did accept me because I really was sick, but I still didn't believe in it. Next to me in bed, in the bed next to me, was Garvin. Garvin, the one who had told. I had seen Garvin around before. His motions were as jerky as little chipmunks out there. He boasted. He was a preening rooster, but he was short and thin and frightened, and I knew all three of those things. He had reasons to boast. Garvin could play. I remember still that Garvin played A minor, Greeks, A minor concerto once, and it just blew me away that one so young, freshman high school, could play Grieg's A minor concerto. He played it once for a banquet. And there he was. So I had dual feelings toward Garvin, huh? This is closure, separation. On the one hand, there were reasons for me to be close to him. I respected what he did. But on the other hand, Garvin started talking, and I started shrinking. Garvin said, I had to. This is in the midst of the conversation. We were side by side for days. He said, I had to tell, didn't I? Didn't I have to tell? And I didn't, you know, I did not want to make any moral decisions. I wanted to be apart from anything. Say yes, say no, shrug my shoulders, whatever, shrink, not get too close to Garvin. I had to tell, he said. I had to tell on him. And Garvin was looking for companions, and I was unwilling to be one. I, who was alone, was unwilling to be a companion. One night, I woke up, and Garvin was next to my bed, kneeling there. Kneeling and just gazing at me, which sent shivers down my spine. Well, there are all kinds of reasons why, you know, shivers would go down your spine at Milwaukee if another boy is kneeling at your bed. He said, do you know what they're doing to me? And I didn't know, but as soon as he said that, I could guess. Because I feared it would happen to me always. He said, all campus blackout. Now, to this day, I don't know if that was true or not, but in Garvin's mind, it was absolutely true. All campus blackout meant that no one would talk to him, that they'd cut him off. All campus blackout, he said. And I don't remember that I talked. I only remember that I shrank. I do remember that I made no decisions for Garvin. Now, this, you must understand, is one of the deeper things that I suffered at that time, is that I did not respond to Garvin. In a week, we were both released. I to my room, Garvin went home. He didn't stay. I stayed. To let you know something of what was going on in me at that time, the first day I was out was a Saturday. I was sitting in the room, and I got my tennis racket. And I took a tennis ball. Nobody was in the dorm on Saturday afternoon. Nobody. And I started going bip-bap against the door. Bip-bap, bip-bap against the door. Our doors had windows in them that went to the hallway. And I went bip-smash. I broke a window, and it made a lot of noise, and I nearly died. I dropped the tennis racket. I ran to that window, and I rammed my hand through the window, and I cut myself. This is where I was. I made a piece of glass, a jagged piece of glass, cut me. I still have a scar. Here, shoom, like that. And then it didn't bleed right away. So I pushed blood out and dribbled it down the window. And there I waited. Eilenfeld came. And Eilenfeld saw the Quinny with his arm sticking out the window, hoping that he'd be shrewd enough to understand what had happened. So I wouldn't have to tell. He was. Eilenfeld was. And there was blessing in him. There was kindness in him that at those days I was not aware of. Because he said, can I help you and can I take you to the nurse? And I said, I was just running at the door. My arm went through the door. Of course, look how I cut it. Like this. You have to go like this to cut it. And he said, I know. He said, I know. You were hitting the tennis ball. Behind me on the floor was the tennis racket. But this is where I was. This is the separation. It was not a deeper or a bad cut. It wasn't. I wasn't quite that deep. But I was a little bit that desperate. De finis. One more part to this, and then I have to switch to the next year and tell you what I did because of it. This was all the separation. I remember in the spring taking the Chicago L, to get to the train, that would take me to Milwaukee, and hating the whole idea. I wore a black suit, and I wore a green sweater underneath the suit. I remember this exactly. It was nighttime. If you know the Chicago L, you know all the things that can go on there. I was alone. And as I was sitting on, I began to hear, I never turned around, I began to hear that a man was singing. He was singing, Dead Truth, Onward Christian Soldiers. And he was drunk. Onward Christian Soldiers. And at first I thought, just keep still, he won't see you, you'll disappear. If any of you read the Book of Sorrows, that's Ferrick. I'm Ferrick now, sitting very, very still. He wasn't going to see me. And then as he sang, I began to realize, I thought, no, he's singing about my suit, my black suit. He thinks I'm a pastor. That went through my mind. And I suffered that. I sat there suffering that. Because if he was singing about me, and he thought I was a pastor, and he was mocking all the religion with honor of Christians, so he might next hurt me. He could hurt me next. That's what I thought. Now, please, I cannot give you rational explanations for this, but what I did then was to unbutton my black coat and very quietly to slide it off. In my heart, I was proving to him I was not a pastor. Do you know what I was doing? I was taking God off. That's how I felt. I was taking all the religion and all the ethics that had been put on me off because it scared me. And when I had taken it off, he said, "All the green grass." Which made me think that I had done what I had just done pointlessly. No good at all. He could hurt me anyway, pastor or not. But this is the separation from all that I had before. I remember taking a walk in that spring for what it is worth. I remember crossing, this is at night again, I always walked at night in Milwaukee, and crossing an intersection. In those days, the streetlights were incandescent bulbs underneath metal fanned covers. And two wires went from one intersection to the other, and it hung over the intersection. It was all dark except for this yellow glow. And I remember hearing that thing swing in the wind, creep, creep. And I almost cried, because to me that was such a lonely sound at night. A bulb out there, and nobody knew the bulb was out there in the ground. And next to it, on a telephone pole, was a poster of a woman in a carnival with her leg kicked high and a bright smile on her face. But the poster was torn, and the date was 2 months old. And I thought, how sad. This is so silly, but I thought, how sad. The woman is still kicking and still smiling, and the carnival is gone, and nobody's watching. That's how I felt. My Han Blechayaki. My Han Blechayaki. It's the first part. The second part will be much briefer. When I went back to school in the next year, I said to myself, I will not stay in this place if I cannot make peace for myself. Now listen how he said it. If I cannot make peace for myself. And I devised a plan. I wasn't going to die. I was going to live. I mean that. That's how big this stuff was. I was going to live. I remembered that I wrote. And this has something to do with the fact that I'm a writer today. I remember that once in the eighth grade I wrote a story which was a lie, but everybody believed it. And I remember sitting there and marveling at the power that I had to write a lie and make people believe. That was the first time I understood how overwhelmingly powerful words are, truth. And so in my second year at Milwaukee, I decided that I was going to be a writer, and I wrote. But I didn't write just for myself, although that was part of it. I wrote because I thought that I would turn the heads of the people around me. It was a plan, a pure, calculated plan. I was going to write so well that they would be dazzled by my language, and I could do it. I didn't know for sure if I could, but I'll tell you what, this is where authors begin. It is not where they should stay, but they begin writing for money. No, for emotional money. They begin writing so that they can do things to the people around them. It is manipulative. It is frightening. Just a quick passage from Grendel. If any of you have read John Gardner's Grendel, you remember when Grendel first hears the poet sing and the effect that the singing of the poet has upon the people around. It says, he sang, or he intoned with a harp behind him, twisting together like sailor's ropes, the bits and pieces of the best old songs. This is in a mead hall. Everyone is sitting around. The shot gets up, strums his lyre, and sings. The people were hushed. Even the surrounding hills were hushed, as if brought low by language. Listen to this, people. He knew his art. He was king of the shapers, harp string scratchers, oak moss bearded, inspired by winds. That was what had brought him over the wilderness down blind man's alleys, he's a blind shop, of time and space to Hrothgar's famous hall. He would sing the glory of Hrothgar's line and gild his wisdom and stir up his men to more daring deeds for a price. He told how, and then if you have time, read that. He goes on to show what magic those words are and how, according to Grendel, this shop, this poet, is able to make things exist that never existed before because people believed it. That's what I did. I said to myself that by the end of that year, I would be able to walk into every one of the rooms in the dormitory peacefully. I could do it scared. I said peacefully, or I would go home and never come back again. And I started to write a story. It was a terrible story in terms of truth. It was a good story in terms of its pattern. I wrote a story, it's chauvinistic in terms of nations, because it's about the Indians. No, it's not about, this is not male chauvinism at this point, this is national chauvinism. And as I wrote the story, I wrote it from the point of view of a white person who was seized by the Indian tribes, savages. You see, I was using the word savages. And who for a while tried to keep his morality and his own culture discreetly inside himself, but finally was broken down and became like one of the savages. You knew what I was doing. I was writing me. And at the beginning, I didn't know that. This is one of the things that was going on for me. I was writing what was happening to me in Milwaukee. The stuff where I wasn't going to make decisions, where I'd at least stay on the fence, I began to become those people, snapping their rat tails, walking around, whispering ugly things about teachers. Even if I didn't say it aloud, I never disagree. That's what I was writing. But I wrote, I tell you this is the first time that I really used language passionately and for reasons of my own life, for my own salvation. I wrote marvelous passages. I wrote dream sequences in which I was set free to describe roiling nature and exploding lightning coming over the people and all the internal feelings that come from such a thing. I remember writing that. And now I did that for a purpose. It wasn't for myself. This is all external. Because I got Jim Hoyer, I picked him out on purpose because he was one who could listen to me, but he was in with the other gang. Got it? Jim came by the door once, and I was tapping the time and furiously. Everybody knew I was a little bit queer. I typed all the time. I read all the time. I read like I was drinking it, you know. And once Jim was in the room, I said, "Hey, Jim, do you want to hear this?" I said it so casually, but my heart was going, "This is my plan." "Sure," he said, Jim Hoyer. Sat down, and I read it to him, just as I talked to you. I read it to him, and he went, "Wally, is that true?" I said, "It's a story." "Oh," he said, "how you write." I said, "Really?" "I knew." "I knew." "Yes," I said. And he left. And I did that very carefully with a few people, and they carried that news, how I wrote, everywhere. And to them it was like magic. It was something they couldn't do. It was something that I could do. I was saving my life. I wrote such a marvelous story. I read it finally to almost everyone. Roger Tim was the most intelligent person in our class. And Roger Tim once came into my room and sat down and leaned back and he said, "Let's talk philosophy." It's true. I didn't know what we were going to talk about, but I said, "Okay. We'll talk about time and space." But the fact that the smartest guy in the class came and said that to me made me quietly realize I was winning. I was surviving. Listen to me, people. I plan to say this. Listen to it. I was building for me a wall around the true Walt and Wally. I was building a protecting wall. I was throwing up a rampart, and no one in that class was going to get on the other side of it. By God. I was building for me a house, an ordered house, in which I could dwell with some peace apart from other people. That was my story. That was my writing. And it was working. I was beginning to discover how much writing does. I was building for me an explanation. I was putting into order things that had been so violently disordered in my life. The story was ordering this horrible experience that had gone on. But I was doing it. And finally, I was building for myself a reputation in that class, and I was doing that self-consciously. But the worst, not best, the worst thing of all is that in the midst of all that, I was building me. I was becoming my own creator. I was becoming my own God. And in the end, I promise you, I saved myself. This is not a happy ending. This is not the end of the tale. I saved myself. Not only could I walk into every room, I did it! I did it! No gift, no grace. I did it. Not only could I walk into every room, but when we graduated high school, you know how they put snarky little cynical sayings about everybody in the class as they graduate? They didn't do that to me. No mock. They said simply, "Walter Wandren, our writer-philosopher, will write a book which is banned in Boston." If you go back to our yearbook, high school graduation, you will see that. Look at the other ones. They snark, they piddle, but I had lifted myself almost to a priest's pedestal, and I was seen hierarchically. Where was holiness then? Where was it? I had ceased to go to the chapel. I had ceased to go for all kinds of reasons. I ceased to go there because I always cried when they sang "Blessed Be the Tie That Binds," and I couldn't stand crying. It was such a lonely song to me. I ceased to go there also because somebody told me that it was a sin to sing in bass. It was separatistic. I had ceased to go there because on the walls they had words printed, which at first I used to fix on, trying to understand what they meant, and finally they meant nothing. It said, "Ora et labora." which they told me is translated work and pray. That's how they translate. Work and pray. Although it really is pray and work. They put work first in the translation. There was sola gratia, sola fides, sola scriptura. There was soli Deo gloria all around me. And I looked at those things and they were utterly meaningless. Not just because they were in Latin, but because I knew what the people sitting next to me in that chapel were like. And I knew what I had become. Now listen to me. The half end of this tale is I saved myself. I did. The bad end of this tale is I had become my own God. This is the self-ascendancy. I don't think that I'm the only one that this happens to. I think this is not uncommon. And I think it's a setup. And I wonder if God just doesn't wait for that to happen, for the setup, so that the soul, the self which has ascended, may next fail. But that'll be tomorrow.